We're expecting Dr. Suzanne Troopen here this morning with us to do our regular program on women's health. I think she's been a little bit delayed, but we're told that she's on the way. So just hang on, and we'll do the usual program we do with her when she's here. She talks a little bit about things that are maybe new and newsworthy in her field, that is women's health. And then also, we open up the phone lines, and it's the opportunity for people who are listening to call in and ask questions. And I know that she would do her best to give you an answer. I always try to caution people when we have physicians on the program that obviously we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. But we hope that by doing these programs, what we will do is add to your store of health knowledge. And so there is the opportunity here for you to call and ask questions. And I know that the doctor will do her best to help you out, or at least to try to respond to your questions. The number, if you're here, happen to be here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. So the local number is 333-9455, and the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. So whichever of those works for you, you can make the call, and we'd be very happy to hear from you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here.
Thanks.
How are you?
Good.
Okay. Are there some particular things that you would like to start out talking about?
Well, I figured that we should start talking about the HPV vaccine.
Yes, good. And interestingly enough, our friend Dr. Bocek was here the other day, and we talked a little bit about that. And he has a sort of a different contrarian view on this. And he said, well, definitely we should give you the chance to talk about it as well. Because he sort of started out saying, well, you know, being a pediatrician, he pretty much believes in vaccines. No question about it. But he said this one he's not quite so sure about, in the sense that, you know, particularly because it's very expensive and because by early screening, if we could actually get women to have pap smears, we could pick up on cancers and then we could deal with them right away. And I guess his question was, and is this, should we really now be blanket immunizing? I guess theoretically, you know, we're going to try to immunize all the girls before they become sexually active. And then I suppose there would be a question, too, about, well, OK, what do we do about adult women? Are we going to give them the shot? And I was just interested in, you know, what your thought on the whole project is.
Right. Well, I did hear about Dr. Bocek's comments from a few phone calls came in directly to me. And I was a little more than disappointed that he wasn't supportive of this vaccine. And it just goes to show that even amongst healthcare providers, we have a lot of education to do. And the vaccines that Dr. Bocek is generally familiar with do prevent infections. Mm-hmm. And if we successfully enough vaccinate everyone, we can stop with that vaccine. I suspect you have the same little dot on your arm that I do from the smallpox vaccine that you and I had to get that we don't give anymore because we've eradicated smallpox, essentially. So I think Dr. Bocek is probably, to some extent, confusing apples and oranges. And I think that we really, in the field of obstetrics and gynecology, can say that, hands down, this is an extremely important vaccine and possibly will be considered one of the major medical advances of our century. As we look back over time, we'll be us looking back over time, of course, and that in part the current way that the FDA requires these things to be developed is in part reflective of why it's so expensive, and the fact that we're trying to show that it cures a particular condition, dysplasia, which takes many years to develop, versus, say, an infection like a whooping cough, which a baby might get, you know, the first couple of months of life. So I think that that the cost is definitely expensive, but probably Dr. Bocek doesn't realize that we spend $6 million plus dollars. I think the recent figure was $6.3 million a year chasing abnormal pap smears in the United States alone. Mm-hmm. So just doing our pap smears is not such an effective cost. You know, we can show it's cost effective, but it's not cheap either. I think that with this HPV vaccine, the fact that virtually every insurance company, if you have vaccination coverage, you probably have coverage for this vaccine. And it's not even been theoretically available to your doctor for more than a month. So that's pretty amazing. I think the insurance companies are already realizing how truly cost effective it is. And what the HPV vaccine is intended to do is, yes, prevent cervical cancer. We know that cervical cancer is caused by a number of different HPV viruses, and two of the viruses that are highly involved are covered by this vaccine. And this vaccine is 100% protective against these two types of HPV-caused cervical cancer and cancer. So, you know, that's pretty amazing right there. And those two types cause about 80% of our cervical cancer. This vaccine also is protective against the two types of virus that cause mild precancerous changes, and also the cases of genital warts. So we're going to protect against about 50 to 75% of precancerous disease in genital warts. And this is a preventative vaccine. We're working on therapeutic vaccines, too, for people already exposed. And there are some unanswered questions. There's no doubt about it. But I think, hands down, you can say it's very important. It's very important for moms to get their teenagers immunized, moms and dads to get their teenagers immunized. It's very important for young women to find out about this vaccine and hopefully get immunized. And yes, the research is ongoing in older individuals who haven't yet had the chance to be vaccinated. And we're thinking that most likely they will show some significant benefit as well.
Hmm. Now, since this virus is in large part sexually transmitted, I guess there are other ways that you can get it. I'm not sure what, but that may be the primary means of transmission. Is there some thinking that at some point it's going to be recommended that boys also get the shot?
Well, I am an investigator in the worldwide clinical trials, so I can't talk about the studies that are undergoing right now. But I can say that definitely they're going to be looking at that. But as you can well imagine, it is possible for men to get penile cancer. It's possible for men to get rectal cancers and anal cancers and urethral cancers and precancerous conditions leading up to those things. But to immediately immunize a young teenage boy for something that cancer that's going to be in a woman 20 to 40 years down the line, that's going to be a little tricky. That is just a radical departure from the way we've delivered medical care in the past. And so we're going to need to do studies to look at what would be the risks and benefits of immunizing boys. The tricky thing is that we've talked about this before. If you have an abnormal pap smear and it's due to HPV, should you get your partner checked and treated? And certainly since it was primarily sexually transmitted and close contact, skin-to-skin contact, oral-to-genital contact, oral-to-other skin contact is possible for transmission of this virus. But it is so important what your own immune system does to clear that virus that treating the partners sometimes isn't the key factor as to whether or not you're going to clear your infection. So definitely men are an important reservoir of this virus. And for eradication of this virus in our population, we need to look at that reservoir. But for prevention of these dysplasias of the cervix, of the vulva, of the vagina, it is very important that the girls get vaccinated first.
Well, I have a couple of callers here. I want to get to them in just a second. Let me just ask one more question now. Has the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology now made an official kind of recommendation about who should be vaccinated and at what age?
Well, the CDC has come out with their recommendation, and when I looked last, I hadn't seen that the American College had come out with their official recommendation. But the vaccine is approved for ages 9 to 26, and CDC says the ideal time would be ages 12 to 13 if we're looking forward in time.
All right. Dr. Suzanne Truppen is our guest. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign every other month, always on a Monday. In the 11 o'clock hour, she's here. We talk about women's health. And if you have questions about this or anything else that is within her area of practice, you can call us. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller here is in Champaign in line one.
Hi,
hello.
My name is, well, doesn't matter what my name is, but anyway, I got, it's a question and a comment. I'll start with my comment first. I did have a leap recently back in March. I had HPV 14, the strain 14. Of, I guess there are like two or three other strains that are, you know, that are problematic in the way that, you know, they can cause cervical cancer. And I just want to say, regarding the doctor who was against the idea, of getting all women vaccinated, it's not something that you can just prevent necessarily with a condom. It does you know, reduce the risk, but it doesn't eliminate it. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. I didn't realize that until I got the procedure. And yeah, the cost that I'm paying financially for the LEAP procedure compared to the cost of the vaccination, I don't think it compares. But my question was regarding the procedure. Like, do you know of any... can you elaborate on what can happen after, like psychologically, the kind of things that can happen to someone, like after they find out?
Okay, you make excellent points, and I know that David went through this at the beginning, and we don't try to treat anybody, but just really quickly, you were just treated clinically by a physician. You weren't in any specific research studies or anything like that, correct?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. The HPV tests that are available clinically, and I haven't seen your chart, so, I apologize if there's something different about your case, but most of the HPV tests that are done clinically classify you as either a high-risk virus carrier or low-risk virus carrier. And when they do these tests, because of the extraordinarily expensive way of separating out which exact HPV you're exposed to, they usually will most test reports will report out that you are a high-risk carrier or a low-risk carrier, and they will give a group of viruses which you may actually be positive for one or all of, or a group of them within that high risk and low risk. And most individuals clinically are not actually given a diagnosis of which specific HPV. And I point that out because, number one, you may want to sit down with your healthcare provider and that HPV test and try to find out exactly what that actually says. And then for listeners who may also have been tested for the HPV virus or had a previous LEAP or any other previous treatments, you may still, in fact, be a candidate for the vaccine because of this very fact that even if you test positive for high-risk viruses, you do not know which high-risk virus you had. And in fact, the vaccine may, in fact, protect against one's variants of the virus that you do not have. And in addition, one thing that's been very interesting in the study is that by giving this vaccine, which is the capsid of a virus, is a little round entity with its naked DNA inside. And the vaccine has yeast cells making this round capsule. And that's what is essentially parts of that capsule are given. And it generates better immune antibody levels than we can detect in people who were naturally affected. So by getting those better antibody levels, it's possible that that will be very helpful to people and they will not progress as much. So that's part of the quote-unquote unanswered questions. But you're absolutely right in your other points that colposcopy, repeat PAPs, repeat visits, surgical procedures. You mentioned to the audience that you had a LEAP procedure. This stands for loop electrosurgical excision procedure, and essentially it's a removal of a cone-shaped piece of tissue from the cervix, some of which that tissue does not completely grow back and some of which that tissue grows back a little bit different than the tissue that was there before. So possibilities of scarring of the cervix, possibilities with fertility, actual conception, and possibilities with carrying a pregnancy are issues that have to be considered whenever we do LEAP procedures. And this is why with LEAP procedures, if at all possible, now we're trying to manage people more conservatively, not do so many LEAPs. And I see we have other callers, so I can't spend all day on this call. But you are absolutely right that, number one, there are potential complications. Number two, follow-up is long and difficult. It impacts on your insurance and if you're going to be moving and what different doctors might say and the struggle that you may undergo all this and still not clear your virus and be at risk for disease later on is definitely something that women find very stressful. And just for being able to eliminate that degree of stress in any percent of the population, and in this case, a huge percentage of people that have undergone these procedures will now in the future, if properly vaccinated, hopefully avoid them. And I think that's an extremely important consequence of the vaccine, which you're absolutely right. People acquire these viruses. 40 million of us Americans have these viruses. And I'm sure all 40 million of us didn't try to get them. You know, so it's a huge public health epidemic, and it's a worldwide epidemic. 500,000 women worldwide get cervical cancer, and so the numbers of women worldwide that get precancer and these other diseases caused by HPV is just immense.
Yeah. I was someone who actually went to the doctor every year, so it's really amazing that I went from in 1 year having nothing abnormal to having high-risk dysplasia, I think is what they – I don't remember the exact name
sure.
for it. But it's – I mean, it's pretty amazing how quickly it happened for me, you know. So, I can't fathom the idea of girls not being protected against this because – It's very emotionally taxing and it's physically taxing. And that is definitely what I found from all of this. So that was really all I wanted to say.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right,
let's go on. We'll talk next with someone in. This is also Champagne and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi. I was curious about, and if you could talk about the maybe the symptoms, or is it only, can you only find out if you've had exposure to HPV through a test? And the other question, because it was strange, we were watching TV last night, my husband and I, and we saw this commercial for genital herpes and treatment of it. And, you know, we were like, wow, do that many people have genital herpes? And then, so what are the symptoms of that? And how do you find out you've got these things, these viruses? Is it only through testing, or do you actually have symptoms that then flare up or something like, and then that's when you start to find out? So I'll just hang up, and if you could call generally about, you know, these kinds of STDs, I guess that's what the human papilloma virus is, a STD, right?
Yes.
Okay, and just find out how do we know we've been exposed to it, and if we have... then you started talking about some of the treatments, and one of them sounded really not good. So if you could just speak a little bit about that, that'd be great. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, I like to differentiate STI from STD. STI means sexually transmitted infection, so you're infected, but you aren't actively infected, so you don't have the STD, the disease. But STD has come to be the initials that we use for this whole class of diseases that is potentially transmitted sexually. And this class of diseases is absolutely immense. There's probably at least 25 common infections and things like hepatitis and those kinds of things are in this category as well. Two of the most common STDs in the United States are herpes and the human papillomavirus. One of the problems with the human papillomavirus is just what we call latent or persistent infection, where you have acquired the virus, but you do not have any active signs of it. It is completely silent and asymptomatic. And yes, unless you get either a Pap test or, more accurately, an actual HPV test, which can be done on your liquid-based Paps, but it can also be done with a separate, it's not really a Q-tip test, it's kind of a brush test. And lots of parts of the body can be tested, but most gynecologists would just test your cervix. When we do research protocols, we test more extensively, of course. It is possible that somebody with dysplasia will have some mild symptoms. It's more likely that somebody with cervical cancer would actually have symptoms, and those symptoms might be vaginal discharge, vaginal bleeding, pain with intercourse, odor discharge after intercourse, general pelvic pain. Those can be signs and symptoms of cervical cancer, but most people do not have those. Herpes, on the other hand, is also an extraordinarily common STD, and it's really tough to know how many people have herpes. We used to estimate that what happens when you first get infected is you get this horrible infection with very painful blisters, and that they persist over 2 to 3 weeks, and that you would know that such an infection has occurred. And yes, many people do that. But then after you have your first infection, it goes into a more modest, controlled kind of infection, because you do start to make some antibodies to the herpes virus, and subsequent episodes are less frequent, they're shorter, they're fewer blisters, they might even be tingling or irritation in the area that you have an infection. Lots of people have this so-called non-primary first infection, where they come in, they get diagnosed based on fairly mild symptoms. I itch, I think I have a yeast infection that won't go away, you know, just relatively minor symptoms, and in fact what they have is recurrent herpes, and they'd never realized that they even had the first infection. Medically we call that a non-primary first episode. It's got kind of a funny name. Actually, now with serum studies looking at your blood levels of antibodies, we find out that only 1 in 10 women, 1 in 10 individuals, women or men, know that in fact they have herpes, and that most of the time when you have an outbreak or you feel that tingling or you see the blister is when you're shedding virus and are infected. But about 6 or 7% of the time, when you think you're absolutely fine, you're actually shedding virus. And so these two things are very different. They're both viruses. Herpes, it's almost impossible to clear your infection. HPV, different. We make some immunity to HPV, and only about something like 1% of people that ever get an HPV infection will have persistent infection.
All right. We're at our midpoint here already with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an OBGYN. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School. Every other month she's here, we do these programs on women's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. No matter whatever else happens with the virus for HPV, the recommendations for getting pap smears are not going to change. And so we're still going to be saying, at least for the foreseeable future, that it is important for women to have, whether they think that there's anything wrong or not, to have pap test.
First pap by age 21 or within 3 years of sexual activity. After that, yearly based on risk. Once you've had 3 negative liquid-based pap tests, and some doctors would add, if you're in 30 or older, add the HPV into that. But once you've had 3 negatives, 3 years in a row, if you are in a low-risk category situation, you might be relegated to the pap part screening every 2 to 3 years. But if you have a uterus and ovaries, you've got to have the pelvic exam, feeling the uterus and ovaries yearly. So most people kind of mush that pelvic exam and pap smear together in their mind. But I think that with these vaccines, more people will eventually be triaged to the every 2 to 3 year screening. So we'll see. We will definitely see benefits on that. And because these vaccines are new, we don't really know. We know because of what we've studied, how effective they are at preventing the HPV and dysplasias due to those virus types. But we don't know yet how effective they'll be. Is there some kind of cross immunity to other HPV types? That we don't know quite yet. So it's too soon to say that that pap smears will be eliminated, but that's certainly a goal. Hmm.
And now there are some women for whom it is recommended that when you have your pap test, there you also check for HPV?
The FDA in the past, I say a year, it could be more like 2 years already, has approved HPV as screening for cervical cancer in women age 30 and over. And that's another mistake that I see practitioners that aren't so familiar with this field. We do use the HPV test to triage patients who have had slightly abnormal paps, but as a general screening tool for people under 30, you do not want to just get HPV testing because it's so common. And so in the absence of other indications, that HPV test as a primary test should be done age 30 and over, because under age 30, you're so likely to clear your virus.
And it's my understanding that it is only certain types of HPV, and there are a bunch of them, that have been implicated in cervical cancer.
Yes.
The vaccine will protect against some of them. So even if we were vaccinating all girls, we're not going to get rid of HPV.
We're thinking that will get rid of about 80% of cases of cervical cancer and high-grade dysplasias. We're thinking that somewhere between 50 and 75% of low-grade dysplasias and genital warts will be eliminated, something in that range. But no, not 100%.
Okay. We're not going to get rid of all the HPV, and we're not going to end cervical cancer just by doing this.
Just by doing this,
but no. But we would put a very big dent in.
Absolutely.
The numbers. Okay. And the next caller is in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I am menopausal, which I think is cause for celebration. but I had an abnormal pap recently, and then they were going to do the colposcopy, but there was a problem with that. So she took a biopsy, and just today I heard as a result of the biopsy, she mentioned low-grade changes. And that I need to come back in 6 months for another pap. But it just sounds like a mystery when you get the news of low-grade changes, because there isn't an explanation that comes with that in terms of what that means. So I was wondering if you could clarify what a low-grade change might be.
There are many good websites that go very much into detail. American Society of Cervical and Clinical Pathology, or something that's like ASCCP,
okay.
Website's pretty good. American Cancer Society has a lot of good information. The CDC has a lot of good information, but I find the CDC website a little hard to negotiate. But
okay.
There are also many other National Cancer Institute. There's like the Women's Cancer Network. I've found extremely good information on things like eMedicine.com. So there are a lot of good places to find information, but there's nothing that can replace sitting down over a desk face-to-face with your healthcare provider and saying, please explain this to me. And to try to explain it without my blackboard, I'm a real big blackboard person, or a scribbling piece of paper is more like it. But basically, the upper layers are the epithelium of our skin or our vagina, the inside of our mouth, anything that's squamous epithelium, and the cervix has, on the outer part of the cervix, has squamous epithelium. On the inner part of the cervix and the inner lining of the uterus, we have glandular epithelium, which are more square-type cells. And our cervix is particularly vulnerable because we have a transformation zone where the glandular epithelium is changing into the squamous epithelium, and we call that the transformation zone. And that is the critical part of what is abnormal in most cases of cervical precancer or cancer. And that is very important based on where your age is and what you've had done to the cervix and your own anatomy, because the transformation zone is nicely sitting on the outside of the cervix prior to after puberty and prior to getting older. And as we get nearer to menopause, that transformation zone kind of sucks up inside the endocervix where we can't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, when you look at a biopsy under a microscope, the upper layers have are bordering the lower layers by this sort of line. It'll be a line on the diagrams called the basement membrane. And if the upper layers have abnormal cells in their first third, we call that CIN1, and we also call that low grade. And if the abnormal cells grow into the second third and the third third, we call it CIN2 and CIN3. CIN2 and 3 are the precancerous, that's where all the cancers primarily come from. And the CIN1 and the warts are usually due to HPV disease that usually does not persist.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, we think that in order to become CIN 2 or 3, you had to go through CIN 1. So it starts to get complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, so it's the earliest, most precancerous change, and just the abnormal area that's just right near the basement membrane. It's a little bit more likely to resolve than the higher grade lesions, and it's significantly less likely to go on to be a cancer. And so that expectant management, in other words, where they select you to either have repeat colposcopies or repeat samplings of the endocervix, the inner part they can't necessarily see, or whether they recommend a conization or leap of some sort or something more, is really in part based on your own healthcare provider's experience and judgment, as well as your own case. In anybody's case where they have been told that the colposcopy may be inadequate, that might be a situation for getting a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But in most young people, and we do like to sit and wait on low grade changes because they are so likely to resolve on their own. As you get to be older, high-grade changes are much more serious. And once they've persisted, the person who comes in and says, oh, I've had years and years of abnormal paps, am I going to ever resolve this infection? Can my own immune system ever fight this off? And we usually try to tell people that possibly, but it's usually going to clear. I think it's most likely to clear in the first 9 months, but I think the more recent studies have said that up to 40 months, something like that. If you haven't cleared by then, you're unlikely to clear.
Ah. Let me ask this, mention this too. My mother is an identical twin, and her twin died of ovarian cancer. So, and mom had had a hysterectomy, and my aunt had not. So is something... Would it make any sense for me to have a hysterectomy, or, I mean, at this point at all, is that a possibility that I should talk to about with my doctor?
Well, ovarian cancer and cervical cancer are not linked genetically, nor are they linked in general by any kind of mechanism other than a rare cervical cancer, which would have metastasized to other pelvic structures. But so any kind of treatment based on ovarian cancer risk is something that you should definitely discuss with your provider. And I think there's going to be a big push to get more and more individuals screened for the BRCA1 and 2, those genetic, those things in our genes that make us more predisposed to cancers like breast and ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not really doing a good job of screening our population right now for various reasons, but there's going to be a big push to get families tested.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Southern Illinois for our next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Just a reiteration. Did I hear you correctly in saying that even if someone under 30 is positive for HPV, that they're still eligible to receive the vaccine?
Yes, they are. There's no contraindication. But it, again, those people, those young ladies may in fact have already been exposed to the virus and might potentially have already contacted the viruses for which this is being given. So there are these people need to sit down and talk to their own healthcare provider and understand the risks and benefits of how to manage their case.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and to Urbana, line number two. Hello. Well, I guess the caller changed their mind. Maybe we answered the question. In any case...
I know these are long answers. It's a complicated topic.
Well,
very complicated topic.
But certainly questions
are
welcome.
I wanted to get back to something that Dr. Bocek said, and a caller alluded to it. But you know, he said, "Hey, we have Pap smears," and the question is, you know, why aren't the Pap smears always working? And that's definitely something to be of concern. First of all, many people do not get regularly screened. So they say approximately 50% of the women in the United States who present with cancer have actually never had a Pap smear. So chasing down those women to get a Pap smear may be important, or maybe we should recognize that we're always going to have a pool of individuals that for whatever reason have not had regular Pap smears or ever even their first. And actually, 30% of women who develop cancer say they've only had normal results. And this is a little bit tricky, and I didn't get a chance to explain this, but cancer cells tend to invade. They grow deep. And some cancers, particularly of the cervix, also tend to get a kind of tough shell to them. And so it's easier on the Pap smear to actually pick up sloughed cells, cells that come off easily with that Q-tip or the brush or however we're sampling the cervix. And because of that, it's easier and more accurate to pick up precancerous changes than already when it's become invasive. And so that's a flaw in the technique, and that's why I think that in some cases the HPV screening, which is based on a different type of test rather than just getting those slough cells, is possibly a very important addition for some people. And we still do have a rate of false negatives in our population, which means that you get your Pap smear, you get your Pap result, you're told that it's normal, but in fact, either because we did not sample the cells that were abnormal, or we couldn't get a good sample, or because of the way it was collected, there are all kinds of reasons, but it persistently within the population, we have cases where women have either precancerous changes or high-grade cancers, precancerous changes or invasive cancer of the cervix, but they've actually had a normal Pap, and that's called a false negative. And again, not getting regularly screened in the past has been a problem as well. We've worked on the technology of the Pap smear. In fact, there was a new monoprep Pap just recently approved by the FDA, which is another kind of liquid-based Pap with slightly different machine technology that's going towards more and more and better automation of the readouts. And I was privileged to work with that company in the development of that Pap smear. So we're making a lot of progress, but still the Pap smear test itself is still not a perfect test, nor does the Pap smear regularly screen for these precancerous changes of the vagina and the meaning the walls of the vagina, not just the cervix, the vulvar area. I have a fairly large group of patients in my own practice that have precancerous changes of the vulva. Again, we think this is a part and parcel of HPV disease, and these changes can be subtle to detect, and they can escape detection. Fortunately, the vulvar pre-invasive disease takes even longer than the cervical disease to progress to cancer, but it's still something that's very important and we're seeing more and more of. And this HPV vaccine has been approved for prevention of high-grade vulvar disease as well.
We have about 10, 12 minutes, and certainly if people have questions, they can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could ask you about something different.
Absolutely.
There's something more. Okay.
Oh, no, we could.
We could talk about that for a long
time. Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll cover this in other shows.
Well, I've been asked by someone to raise this with you. Someone would like to have you talk about inflammatory breast cancer. And says that she had been hearing some about it and reading some about it, particularly about the fact that it was something that you can't palpate it. You can't pick it up on breast self-exam. You can't pick it up on a mammogram. That it makes it sound like it's potentially very serious and it doesn't have a lot of really dramatic symptoms, or not at least things that you pick up by the traditional things that we've talked about for the other kind of breast cancer. And I don't remember ever having actually heard of it. I don't think I've ever actually heard of it.
Well, there are many different tissue types that cause invasive breast cancer. And we usually talk about those tissue types that occur either in the ducts, the tubes leading to the glands themselves, or in the glands itself. So we talk about ductular cancers and lobular cancers, which are the glands themselves. And there are several tissue types within each of those. And yes, there is this condition, inflammatory breast cancer. Now, we usually quote about a 3% false negative rate with mammograms, just like pap smears have false negative, mammograms have false negative as well. And when you get your mammogram, your radiologist is specifically looking for something different in any part of the breast. And sometimes the cancer that's there is just too small. So it's so tiny that there's no physical change in the mammogram. But sometimes the cancer tissue is so identical to the tissue surrounding it, it doesn't show up as a distinct entity. And same with the feel. When we do what's called the clinical breast exam, where the physician or healthcare provider is actually examining your breast, they're looking for a change in feel. And if the feel of that area is exactly like the feel of the other areas of your breast, suspicion is not aroused. And so inflammatory cancers, particularly in their early stages, seem to escape detection. So that in general, when we find an inflammatory cancer, it tends to be a little bit more advanced. And people say, oh, this large area just popped up overnight. But in fact, it didn't. It just wasn't clinically detected till it got a little bit larger.
Well, how common is this particular form?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember the exact statistic, but it's much less common than the other types of breast cancers.
Mm-hmm. And is it something that still you are going to be likely to pick up on at the point where you can actually do something and hope treatment would be successful?
Cancer treatments are progressing all the time. And through the proper use of chemotherapy, radiation, novel kinds of treatments, even surgical kinds of treatments, cancer cure rates, even for what we used to consider the most serious kinds of cancers across the board, have dramatically improved. And the earlier we find a cancer, the more likely we're going to cure it. But yes, it is still possible to be cured, even if you are diagnosed with an inflammatory cancer that's a little bit advanced.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We'll go to a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes. Your practitioner suggested that ovarian and cervical were not genetically linked, and I was very surprised by that, and I wondered if she could expand on that.
Well, we think that we don't really know all the causes of ovarian cancer. We see a trend after you've used 10 to 15 years of hormone replacement therapy. We see a trend in individuals who have ovulated incessantly, meaning people who haven't used birth control pills, people who haven't been pregnant, people who have not breastfed, has something to do with ovulation. And we haven't really established that there's a specific like an infection like HPV. HPV is an epithelial virus, meaning that it attaches to squamous epithelium. So the urethra, the vagina, the vulva, the skin, the anus, the rectum, the cervix, anything that's squamous epithelium. Once you get up inside, immediately inside the cervix, those glandular cells right in the lower part of the uterus and the inner cervix, they may be a little bit susceptible to the HPV virus. But once you get up inside the lining of the uterus itself, the fallopian tube, the ovary, we've not really shown that HPV disease can cause cancers in those structures. There's been some suggestion that talc powder that can make its way through the cilial, the little hairs that bead on top of cells, can make its way all the way from the cervix and into the abdomen, has been implicated in ovarian cancer. It's a little bit different mechanism than cervical cancer.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So, again, that one of the things about breast cancer, for example, if you ask the question, what increases your risk of developing breast cancer, it is, do you have a close, your mom, your aunt, your sister, someone who is a close female relative that had it? But in the case of ovarian cancer and cervical cancer, that's not as much the case.
Well, ovarian more so than cervical. There's something about our immune system that leads us to developing cancers, because we pop up with cancer cells all the time. So there's something about our own genetics that allows us to fight off cancer cells in any parts of our body. There's something about our diet, whether we get those omega-3 fatty acids in, that allows us to fight off any kind of cancer. So if we go far enough back into our genetics, we start to muddy the waters here conceptually. But even with breast cancer, only about 1 in 5 breast cancers seems to have a genetic link. So most breast cancers out there do not have a genetic link that we can find. And so even in families where 3 family members may have the breast cancer, there may be no specific genetic problem within that family that we can identify that actually caused that breast cancer. Odd, though, probably none of the patients believe that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe it, but that's what the studies show.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Mattoon, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about osteoporosis. I wondered if there was any new medicine for it. I don't take Fosamax now. I take Avista and plenty of calcium, but I seem to be getting worse.
Well, there are many, many potential treatments of osteoporosis. First is to establish the degree of your osteoporosis and the cause of your osteoporosis. And there are, in fact, women who have certain medical conditions or nutritional conditions that can be making their situation worse. When it comes to a diagnosis of osteoporosis and then what's your laundry list of treatment options, you've got estrogen in there, and it's definitely still a treatment for women who have other reasons to be on estrogen or who have reasons that they can't take anything else. There's definitely the bisphosphonates, and there are now 3 on the market. And that would include the Fosamax that you mentioned, plus Actonel and Beneva. And there are other bisphosphonates in testing that we're looking into that may show a lot of promise as well. And then there are these SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators. And the first one on the market was Avista. And basically, we nickname these as sort of chemical estrogens or designer estrogens. Essentially, what they are is an actual molecule that's made to act like estrogen on certain tissues, anti-estrogen on other tissues. So, for instance, the Avista acts like estrogen on the bone and helps to both treat and prevent osteoporosis, whereas Avista actually has now been shown to help prevent breast cancers, and they're hoping to actually get that indication and be a reason to prescribe women that therapy to help prevent breast cancer. So that's a little sidelight. Also, a little sidelight on SERMs is that some SERMs actually can act like estrogen on the walls of the vagina and help treat that vaginal dryness and atrophy that women in menopause get. And I currently have 2 different research studies that are enrolling, looking at new novel SERMs, cousins of Avista, that may even have some benefits over Avista and be useful for treating the vaginal dryness in women who either select not to use estrogen or want to moderate their dose of estrogen. So there's a lot of action going on there in CIRMS, and there will be some new alternatives. One of the CIRMS that we're testing for vaginal dryness has also been tested for osteoporosis, and I believe that the media has talked about that company seeking approval for that drug's use in osteoporosis. So there's going to be something new. There's also parathyroid hormone, PTU, and that is indicated for women with more dramatic osteoporosis. What you do is you come off your, ideally, like your bisphosphonates or your Avista, you take that for 2 years, and then you go back on. And because it has a different mechanism, it actually adds bone. Avista, bisphosphonates, and estrogen prevent bone loss, but they do not add bone to most individuals. But the parathyroid hormone can actually add lost bone back.
What if you have a low thyroid anyway?
Thyroid is a little bit different hormone. It's important that your thyroid is regulated so that your bone health can be maximized, but parathyroid hormone and thyroid hormone are actually two different treatments.
So you would be able to, if you were on thyroid medicine, to use it?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. But it's expensive. It's a daily injection. It's a daily injection.
Oh.
So it's a little bit troublesome, but they've really designed some of these new injectables. They're designed so well and so easy for patients to use that it's not a big deal. And I've tried out a lot of these needles, and I'm a wimp.
Oh,
and
you do your own.
No, well, I try them out. Try things out. And many of these products are very easy to use.
Oh, the patient does their own.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Like insulin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. There we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. With the promise that Dr. Troopin will be back again. This would be in what month is it? You'll be back in September.
Yes.
All right. She's here now every other month, still always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. Dr. Suzanne Troopin is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She also teaches here at the U of I College of Medicine, Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Being here.